Today I want to talk about an idea that I've been exploring for some years, and it's resurrected itself in my attention. It is healing our fears of the energy exchanges that we fear. Kind of a complicated statement. Healing our fears of the energy exchanges we fear. A few years ago, I was trying to, it's a continuing quest to understand life. I used to say, I'm just trying to understand the cosmos, what life is, what rules apply, and so on. And I developed what I consider to be a model of energy use, or the model of energy that seems to explain what we do as human beings. Now, I already had the habit of trying to see everything in terms of energy, not physical matter, not chemicals, not symptoms. I was trying to see everything in the context of energy. And sometimes I could do that effectively and other times not. But it seemed very clear to me, since everything is energy, and I believe everything is conscious energy, we seem to always be involved in energy exchanges. We're exchanging energy with everything else. And I thought, oh, okay, that's cool. We exchange energy through our five senses, right? Light comes into our eyes, reflected off whatever it is we happen to be looking at. We eat food. We exchange energy with the earth when we walk on it. You know, we press our foot down and we pick up and press our foot down, and the earth provides support or energy or something for us to push off against. It's like, okay, that makes sense to me. I think we exchange energy when we inhale and exhale. Like, eat food, yep, excrete, even when we talk, we're exchanging energy. Even if we're only talking to ourselves, we're exchanging energy. And it goes on and on and on. We exchange energy with objects of attention that are not visible. So we're exchanging energy when we think about something or someone. We go, and we do that with our thoughts, with our feelings. And if we're speaking to ourselves or it, that concept, we're exchanging energies. So one view is that life consists of energy exchange experiences. We can say, well, you know, a successful life, that means those energy exchange experiences primarily cause desirable effects. Go, okay, yeah, he was successful. That baseball player was successful. He got a hit, or he drove in a run, or he prevented a run from scoring, or somebody was growing something. They were successful at causing that thing or contributing to that thing growing. Okay. And I think we judge ourselves as unsuccessful when the effects of our energy exchanges are undesirable. Oh, man, that's not what I wanted. Oh, I dropped the egg on the floor. That's not what I was wanting to do. I wanted that egg to be broken and end up in the frying pan, and the shell goes into the trash. I didn't mean for it to go onto the floor. So as I was considering this human behavior of human energy exchange experiences, the structure of what I call my energy model of life started to become clearer to me. I said, what do we do? What do we do? Well, it became obvious to me that we're designed to acquire energy. So energy acquisition was the first step of my energy model. Like, newborn babies come out of the womb, have a sucking instinct. That instinct is to acquire energy. They're trying to acquire the energy of mother's milk, and perhaps on a level non-physical, although conscious, is to be close and connected to the mother that they were recently inside of. So they want to get that closeness, that contact, that physical touch. You go, okay, well, that makes a lot of sense. And it's been known by people who do research on infants that an infant that is born and is handed to its mother and instantly is on the chest close to the heartbeat, this is the same heartbeat that that infant pre-birth was used to. You go, oh, there it is, there it is. Even though, baby, you're now outside of your first apartment, certain things are still predictable. And the warmth, the love, the energy of that. And so there's great value in that connectedness. And that is an energy acquisition process. Frankly, it's known that it's tremendously valuable to the mother to have that baby placed on the mother's chest immediately after birth, not whisked off into some part of the hospital where they're going to be processed like a little piece of meat. Oh, we got to do this and got to do that and wash this and do all of that stuff. That could wait another hour. And to allow this baby to get acclimated and stay connected outside of the womb in this new world that it just entered. And we interfere with that energy acquisition, for the most part, in the Western method of childbearing, much to the disadvantage of the baby, much to the disadvantage of the mother. I thought, this is kind of interesting. This is interesting. Sometimes I talk to a client who says, oh, I got bad feelings. I stole something as a child. Me too. I took the cookie and, I wasn't supposed to. I took the pack of gum and I wasn't supposed to. Me too. And you think, what is that? What is that? That's energy acquisition. It's what human beings do. We did it when we were infants, minutes old. It's what little children, corrupt politicians, and everyone in between, when we take what doesn't belong to us. It's simply energy acquisition. It's what we do. Now, the ideal scene, of course, is that we start to grow in awareness and go, this is mine and this is theirs. Okay, all right, got it. I understand there's some sort of invisible boundary between those two things. Not everybody understands that, obviously. Look at a bank robber or a Wall Street banker, a lot of different people who go, yours is mine and mine is mine. Like, oh, that seems like an unfair tilt to the playing field. And of course it is. If you turn around and think, you know what? Everything is energy, right? Everything is energy. It is either energy with the frequencies speeded up, high vibration energy that like love, this invisible concept, or the divine consciousness, an invisible concept, or Christ consciousness, an invisible concept, very high vibration, very high frequency. And you look at a rock, or the ground, or anything else for that matter, and go, oh, I get it. That it's just vibrating at a lower frequency. When you look at solid material things in your presence, it's just an example of a slower vibration. The frequencies are reduced so we can perceive them with our five senses. Oh. Some people believe if you can't perceive it with your five senses, it doesn't exist. Really? Really? Radio waves? TV waves? Bulk forms? Maybe there are examples. Maybe there are exceptions to this rule. Yeah. Okay. Because things are physical and it's very easy for us to relate to things that we can sense with our five senses, for lots of people it's like, I forgot that was energy. I forgot that the TV was energy. I forgot that the computer was energy. I forgot that the floor and the ground and the chair and a glass of water were energy. Oh, yeah. It's energy and it has consciousness. It is consciousness. Think of it. Bricks to construct a building are energy. So are the blueprints that are designed for the building of that building. So is the ground on which that building is going to be constructed. And so is the money that will pay for the bricks, the blueprints, the materials, the land, and the people who will do the energy exchanging with the bricks and the plumbing and the wood and the pipes and the wires and all the rest of the stuff in order to build that building. If we look at a thin person and an overweight person, if we look at a rich person and a poor person, we could be seeing the differences in their willingness and their ability to acquire energy in various forms. Twinkies are energy. So is water. So, that's interesting. Last night I watched a couple of episodes of a Netflix series called Lillehammer, after the place in Norway where the Winter Olympics had been held years ago. It was recommended yesterday by a friend, and I found those two episodes to be very entertaining, and I look forward to seeing the next 5 or 6 or 7, however many there are. But the main character in this series is a mafia guy who turned state's evidence when his peers tried to kill him a few times. And then he went into the witness protection program, and he didn't want to be in the U.S. He wanted to be in Lillehammer. And so it's entertaining from that standpoint. Now, just think of it. Mafia guys, now most of us don't know anybody who falls into this in actuality, only what we see on TV and stuff. But mafia guys acquire energy, I'll say money, power, influence, etc., in ways in which you and I wouldn't be willing to do. We would go like, oh, no, that's abhorrent. We wouldn't be able to do that. We're not, no, that wouldn't work for us energetically. We would lose energy if we tried to acquire energy in those particular forms. I created this rule of human behaviors, and it serves me well, and I think it's valid. I have yet to come across examples of it not holding true. Everyone acts in their own self-interest according to their own level of awareness. I think this is true for a caveman, a mafia guy, and a saint. The difference between those three is the level of awareness. I found this interesting years ago when I first came across it. They arrested some famous bank robber. I forget his name. We're talking 20 or 30 years ago, and maybe the bank robber's time was even earlier than that. And I came across the quote, "So why did you rob banks?" And the guy was like, thought the question was unbelievably silly and so obvious. And his answer was, "Because that's where the money is." It's like, well, that's right. That's where the money is. But that's not the only place money is. You could say that bank robber was not very conscious of alternative means of energy acquisition. He saw money there, me take. Like, okay. That's pretty unaware. So the more conscious a person is, the more aware a person is, the more they're going to be moving toward that saint end of the spectrum. The saint end is the recognition and the consciousness that we are all interconnected. We're not separate and distinct. We're all interconnected. What's good for you is good for me. A saint thinks like that. Caveman, or I suppose a mafia guy, would say, what's good for me is good for me. I'm sorry, but I don't really care about what's good for you. It's my self-interest is the only self-interest. You know, but we're interconnected. I don't understand that concept. I am not conscious of that idea. That's true. Sometimes we look at some of these people that get away with stuff, acquire a huge amount of energy, and go, I'd just love to do that. And a lot of these movies on TV seem to be related to this idea. If I can rob one bank, then I can live happily ever after. If I can do one huge drug deal, I can live happily ever after. If I can, you know, invent one great thing and sell it for a gazillion dollars, I will be happy. I think the challenge is that nobody can consistently act or behave, think or feel or speak outside the range of their consciousness. It's like, oh, if I could just do something that I can't do just this one time, make a big, big bundle of money, then I'll pull back into my comfort zone. I don't think that's workable. And maybe one of the points of view that sustains that idea is that people who win the lottery all of a sudden score big money, but over time fritter it away, lose it, poorly invest it, that sort of thing, and end up right back where they were. So having acquired that money, which is outside of their consciousness, somehow there was a opening in their consciousness that allowed the money to come in, but then it's like, this is, you know, I don't resonate with this, I don't energetically align with it, I got to get rid of it. And they do. And more about that in a few minutes. So I think the reality is that expanding our consciousness is, number one, our goal. It's the reason to be alive. And number two, it's a slow, gradual process. You know, we'd all like, give me two of those things. Let me take them tonight, and I'll call you in the morning, tell you I'm healed, I'm happy, I'm successful, I'm this, I'm that. Like, that magic pill is not known to exist. So, if my rule is accurate, we all act in our own self-interest according to our level of awareness. How does that apply to being overweight or being impoverished or being ill? But on the one hand, our lips would say, whoa, you know, being overweight is not in my best interest, it's not my self-interest, and being impoverished is not in my self-interest, and being ill is not in my self-interest. I think this stuff happened to me. Okay, that's a point of view. Lots of points of view on this. I wouldn't personally have that point of view. I see us as far more causative, far more creative in this process. So in the context of that first phase of my energy model, energy acquisition, how could it be in a impoverished or poor person's self-interest to not acquire more money? How could it be in the overweight person's self-interest to continue adding energy but not expending it? How could it be in the ill person's self-interest to not acquire the awareness and means to become healthy? So that's really the theme of this talk. And this is clearly going to be part one of at least two. Healing our fears of the energy exchanges that we fear. Do we fear the consequences of extending our energies to acquire what we want and what we need? Are we not willing to reach out our energies? And I'm extending my hand out almost as if that represents this act of extending my energy. Just think of that. Extending my energy. Extending your energy. If we were looking at a plant, we would go, I want my plant to grow. Should it or should it not extend its energy? Should it extend its leaves toward the sun? Should it extend its roots deeper into the soil of Mother Earth for nutrition and nourishment? And we would say, of course it should. That extending of energy is an indication of growth. We go, okay. So do I fear extending my own energy? If I said to a turtle, how do you feel about extending your energy? The turtle might say, you mean my legs outside of the shell and my head outside of the shell? So, yeah. How do you get from point A to point B otherwise? Oh, I don't. I have to extend my energy outside of my shell in order to have my feet touch the ground and waddle forward. And my head has got to come out of the shell to see where I'm going, to keep me on track, and also to perceive danger, at which point I'm going to pull back into my shell. So, do we fear extending our energies to acquire what we want and need? Do we fear our energy acquisition habits for fear of experiencing not enoughness? So, I want to reach for a Twinkie. This is my 82nd Twinkie today. I'm not going to reach for it. That's the energy form that some people use to anesthetize themselves with. Food energy. High fructose corn syrup, that's good. It stimulates, it makes me... Well, it doesn't make anything good. That's pretty clear. It doesn't do anything good for us. But it can distract us. It's like throwing newspaper, roll up a piece of newspaper into a ball and throw it onto a fire in the winter, and you see a big flame. You go, this is a good idea. Whoops, it just went out. That flame only lasted for a second and a half, 2 seconds. Maybe I ought to put a log on the fire. Some slower, longer, more durable energy form onto that fire. High fructose corn syrup, newspaper, rolled up, thrown on the fire. Ooh, I felt that. Ooh. And we go right down again. But it's the way we keep our anxiety of not enoughness under control in some cases. You see a person standing outside of a building in the winter, in a sleet, smoking a cigarette, and you say, why do you do that? I like to. You like to be outside freezing your butt off in the cold and the snow and the rain and the sleet, smoking a cigarette, putting particle-laden air into your lungs, spending a lot of money on the process and time and effort, and what you do is you get out of it on a physical level smelling like an ashtray. You waste money and you smell like an ashtray, but you bring your anxiety to a lower level. I think it's the reduced anxiety that I like. The cigarettes, nicotine, cause the anxiety and require, like a demanding taskmaster, that you use more nicotine in order to keep it quiet. What's interesting to me in this regard, and by the way, I'm an ex-smoker, quit smoking in January of 1975, so I'm well aware of the nastiness of this habit. And I smoked when I was a little kid, too, so that's a long time. Is you watch somebody, and I know this from personal experience, somebody is a smoker, watch them cough. Hear them cough. It will be a matter of seconds before they reach for a cigarette, as if the red light on my dashboard, my lungs, told me I need more smoke and I need more cigarettes and nicotine in me. Like, wow, How do you think you got this, that vicious, nasty, nasty cough that sounds like it comes from the bottom of your feet? Where do you think you got that from? I don't have time to talk about that. I got to go outside and stand in the sleet and snow and rain and do the habit I like so much. Okay. We would fear not enoughness in this kind of situation. I wonder if the reason for some of us why we don't extend our energy to acquire what we need and want is because, number one, I might not extend my energy perfectly. I might not do it perfectly. And I fear the consequences of being a little ineffective, a little clumsy, a little imperfect, or a lot imperfect. Maybe it goes back to that original metaphor that I used in here, this idea of I was going to make an omelet, but I'm not sure I'm capable of carrying an egg from the refrigerator 4 steps to the stove and cracking it so it ends up in the frying pan, which I had to be wise enough and skillful enough to get up to a certain heat. Like, wait a minute. You think perfection is the goal of our activities? Yeah, of course it is. Of course it is. No, it isn't. Trial and error is the road to learning how to become more effective. I thought the road was labeled perfection. You mean to tell me it's labeled trial and error? Yeah. What do you think education is? Trial and error. You're learning stuff that people learned by trial and error. As you sit there in elementary school and junior high and high school and college, you're learning what they learned through trial and error. They didn't learn it through perfection. I got this perfectly, and I'd like to deliver it to you perfectly. That's not happening. It never happened. Trial and error is a process of life. It's like, why didn't they tell me? I'd been on a tightrope of perfection, falling, beating myself for falling off the tightrope of perfection. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's exactly what happens to us because our teachers didn't know and they passed it on to us. Well, you mean to tell me I can reach for what I want? I can acquire the energy, and if I don't do it effectively, I can learn from that and do it again and do it again and do it again and do it again and do it again? Exactly. Oh. The rightness of this approach, trial and error, is overlooked when we hold up Thomas Edison and his search for the incandescent light bulb. I was like, oh, he failed 9,000 times, and, you know, like, trial and error. It brought him to narrow this very, very wide road of trial and error. It became narrower and narrower, and it got him to his destination, the incandescent light bulb. Like, so, if you want to find something fantastic, be prepared for a lot of trial and error. If you don't want to create anything, go for perfection. Oh, that's why I'm holding back. I thought the rule was perfection. Exactly. And that's why so many of us timidly hold back our natural energy acquisition impulses. It's natural, right? I go back to the infant. We start that way. Heck, I can go even earlier and say, oh, there's a fertilized ovum within that woman. And a woman is not going, oh, I got to acquire energy for this ovum. I got to acquire energy today. Oops, I forgot to do it yesterday. Uh-oh. That's not what's happening. This is naturally designed. This is divinely designed. And that ovum, take it in, acquire. 9 months later, like, comes out, and like, hey, I want to acquire some more energy. I want peace. I want security. I want connectedness. I want mother's milk, which is really the material form of the energies that I want. So hold me to your chest, Mom. Feed me. Yeah. You want formula, baby? No, I don't want formula. I want to be held against my mother's chest. I want that breast milk for her good as well as mine, because it helps her body normalize to have this. It helps our connectedness, our nurturing and caring capabilities, our ability to bond. Like, oh, I get it. I get it. But here we are, in a lot of cases, timidly holding back our energy acquisition impulses, all these normal things. I'm not gonna reach out for fear of breaking this egg or putting my hand on a hot stove or being yelled at or some other form of imperfection. It's like, we're like car drivers with the foot on the brake or the car in park. How you doing today? Okay, I'm not making that much progress, but I'm okay. But your car is in park. Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Okay. So each of those questions, for the purposes of today's talk, they're rhetorical in these moments, but they're not rhetorical for each of us after the talk. And I think it makes sense to believe that the answers to each of these questions, why our energy acquisition is less optimum, less effective than it could be, I think those answers exist. They exist in this field around us. They exist in this ocean of consciousness. And we go, oh, wow. And if they're not apparent to our individual awareness yet, I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer. You go like, I want to know the answer. We can open the doors to our hearts and our minds, reach out for that, and allow that enlightenment, allow that awareness to penetrate our human consciousness. That's why my foot is on the brake. Oh, that's why I do what I do and I don't do what I want to do. I think so. Maybe part of this is related to the second phase of my energy model of life. Energy preservation. Energy preservation. It should be pretty apparent to those of us who live in the United States that some people are more devoted to protecting the energy they've acquired than other people. If you look at the American political and economic systems, you go, I think the rich do a really, really fantastic job of acquiring the energies they want and preserving them. They protect them. They protect their acquired energies through, I'll say, tax loopholes or high-powered legal and financial counsel, by the influence that they wield on a political level. Yep. These people are able to influence legislation to protect their interests, often at the expense of others who can't protect themselves as well. The whole thing about the criminalization of cannabis, hemp, both the industrial plant as well as the marijuana plant, if you will, that's used for medicine and recreation, the reason that's illegal is because it threatened the economic interests of William Randolph Hearst. Hemp is a better source of wood pulp. William Randolph Hearst had his investment, besides owning a publishing empire, in timber. Timber being the source of pulp that could be turned into newsprint. Wait a minute. I'll be William Randolph Hearst. Wait a minute. You mean to tell me that there's a better way to get newsprint than my timber? I can't have that. I cannot have that. That would make half of my empire or some large portion of it virtually worthless. That's a narrow-minded point of view, right? There's not enoughness. There's scarcity. Wood is highly desirable. Doesn't have to be newsprint. It could be furniture and about a gazillion other things. But he saw hemp as a threat, and that was the beginning of the campaign to demonize it and throw in some serious racism to boot. Those Mexicans smoking that stuff, raping your children and your women and your whatever else you got that could be raped. Yeah. Okay. These people have a lot of influence to protect and preserve the energies they've acquired. Consider this, though. Here's a little ripple on this. Have you ever known a person who earns, that is, acquires, a lot of money but can't seem to protect it? You know, every time I read it or notice something in the paper, I get the New York Times Online, not because I'm opposed to newsprint, William, but I don't think it's environmentally moral for me to have 4 pounds of newsprint delivered to the house. It's just, I'm one person. Something's wrong with that picture. So anyway, when I come across this celebrity, this movie star makes millions, has to file for bankruptcy. Like, huh? They couldn't protect their money? They couldn't protect what they acquired? Yeah, they couldn't. They couldn't, or they didn't, or they weren't willing to, or they didn't know how to, but they surrounded themselves with people who siphoned it off. Those siphons, right? Parasite. They sucked that money out of this guy or this gal's income and left them destitute. Wow. I wonder if this second issue, energy preservation, whether it has to do with boundary issues. I think it does. I think it does a lot of times. If our boundaries, and I'm talking about spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical boundaries, are violated early in our lives, we could be living in anxiety. It's like, there's nothing that separates me from everybody else. There's nothing, there's no dividing line. People can come into my space, my energetic, my spiritual, my mental, my emotional, my physical space, and do what they will. Like, yikes. That anxiety would be akin to, say, a farmer. Farmer says, I got crops out there, but my fences have been damaged, so a deer or other foraging animals, to include people, can come through the opening in the fence and help themselves to my stuff, my energy. I think rebuilding our personal boundaries is essential to our individual identities. And I'm not talking about making walls between us and other people. Simply dividing lines that we're willing to maintain. It's more like a decision about our space, all of those spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical space, that we have a right to define and defend, and we have a responsibility to do it. If we think of our boundaries as the container of our energy, kind of like a bottle could contain water, or a car that contains us as we drive along the highway, And this is different than the farmer or a rancher who has a fence or a boundary made out of wood or wire. Our personal boundaries are first and foremost energetic. We create or don't create them out of the energy through our thinking, our feeling, our words, and our action. That's how we construct our boundaries, what we say to ourselves. Are we vulnerable or are we safe and protected? It's that choice of focus is causative. I think some of our early religious training teaches us to let down our natural tendencies to self-protect. And I think that's, unfortunately, one of the reasons why priests have been so successful at being a pedophile predators. Oh, he's a priest. I'm vulnerable. I'm completely open, and boom. When I was in California years ago, when I lived there, in the 90s and early 2000, is I noticed that the scams were very often, and I noticed that today, and I noticed it as of yesterday again, often start with somebody professing their allegiance, alignment, complete compatibility with Jesus Christ and Christianity. And you go, okay, that's the opening line. Well, the innocent and the naive, no one who talks like that could be a bad person. They couldn't possibly use Jesus' name like that. They couldn't possibly say stuff like that and have ulterior motives. They couldn't be bad people. Well, I seem to remember some childhood fable. I don't really recall the details of it. Something about a wolf in sheep's clothing. Oh, I also just flashed on the Trojan horse from Greek mythology or history. Oh, yeah. Why do we call a parasite a problem? Because a parasite's energy acquisition methods will result in a loss of energy to the host. That is not a win-win situation. That is a win-lose. And we would be on the losing end of that transaction. That energy exchange experience? Win-lose. Oh, that's not what I had in mind. No kidding. Couldn't we even say that the bankers and the Wall Street people who created that financial collapse a few years ago were parasites? They certainly took energy from the U.S. and world economies, weakened, disempowered, and drained the people. Like, oh yeah, yeah, that's what parasites would do. Are we afraid to protect our boundaries and the energies that we've acquired because we fear the potential consequences of losing even more if we stood our ground? If there was an extreme reaction to our standing our ground? There are a lot of systems out there that are much more difficult to people of color than they are to white people. Standing the ground as a white person is less dangerous than standing your ground as a person of color. If you're a black man or Hispanic man, you got a different experience coming your way in a lot of places in America. Maybe even as children, we don't speak our truth at the dinner table for fear of the reaction of our parents, or we don't speak our truth in school for fear that that teacher will retaliate with a bad grade or some other form of energy loss, humiliation. That's a tool commonly used in school settings and even work environments today. If we want to create something of great value in this world, we're going to have to contend with this idea. I would say this desire to cause huge effects that will be positively influencing people and the planet is going to trigger some reaction to other people who are opposed to that form of empowerment. I mean, there's no secret that the Pharisees and the Sadducees and even the ignorant people in the end were opposed to Jesus' teachings. He wasn't really a warmonger. He was going to influence the balance of power through his energy exchanges, his teaching and his preaching. And that was seen as a threat. But here we are, more than 2,000 years later, and I'm talking about Christ consciousness and the influence that he has had over 2,000 years on you and on me. And ideally, the best influences are yet to come. One of the things that's interesting to me, and actually it's more scary than interesting, is to realize that some of the people who are most successful at acquiring energy, and I'm talking billionaires, and preserving that energy through influence and legal and maybe extra-legal activities, are the ones most committed to destroying the planet. They're not at all interested in preserving Mother Earth. Like, they're like, I'm so busy, like a parasite or a cancer cell, doing what I'm doing, and I'm not really looking at the broader, deeper, long-term effects of this behavior. Like, yeah. I don't know how they don't see the need to protect and preserve the planet that all of us live on. So to recap part one of this talk on the subject of healing our fears of the energy exchanges that we fear. 3 points. What energy forms do you want to acquire? What conditions in your life indicate either too little energy or too much energy acquisition? 2nd point. Consider your willingness and your ability to preserve your energy. If you open your doors to predators and parasites, you want to have that experience. But you can heal your awareness that leads you to do that in the past. You can heal whatever was suggesting to you that that's a good idea to be sacrificed to a predator or a parasite. You can heal that, and you can make new decisions about your own self-interest. And the 3rd point, watch and notice the energy acquisition behaviors and the energy preservation behaviors of yourself and other people. And you'll hear it in the way you talk to yourself, and you'll hear it in the way other people behave and speak aloud. You're not going to be able to read their thoughts, but you'll be able to read their behaviors. Like, I want to, it's too much energy. What is that? Says, I haven't acquired enough energy, and I have to preserve what little teeny bit I have. That's a lie. But if we have that habit, we can heal it. But first thing, we need to be aware of it. I'd like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 of Christ Returns. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. Wow, doesn't that give a lot of hope to energy acquisition? We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you're perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness. And as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.